5. Okay, good morning. It is October 17th, 2011. We have a work session on case number PU-11-542 and case number PU-11-654. This is just an initial opportunity for the commission to become a little bit more familiar with the legalities of the case and facts of the case or the cases. And good morning and welcome, first of all. Maybe what we should have happen is have everyone around the table identify themselves, and then I'm guessing Alana will probably turn it over to you since you authored the memo that will serve as the basis for most of our discussions today, and then go from there. So this is Tony Clark.
Kevin Kramer, good morning.
Brian Culk, good morning.
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Mark Grumman.
Patrick Fawn.
Why don't we have others who are in the room identify themselves?
Jerry Leon.
Carol Larson.
You're on your own over there.
Chris Merle.
Okay, and Esther Jangler is here as well. On the phone?
Bruce Gerhardson's with us on the phone. Bruce?
Yes, I'm on the phone.
Okay. Very good. With that, Alana?
This is simply very preliminary because I was just trying to sort out kind of what had been filed. So I had a simpler list and the laws that had been cited that the parties assert are applicable. And hopefully if we just work our way through it a little bit, we will have some conclusions about the first question that needs to be answered, the second question that needs to be answered, and that sort of thing. There was another document that you got this morning that hadn't been docketed yet, and it was the answer to the complaint. And when I was working on the memo, I also kind of realized that at least these beginning documents in the complaint need to be in both cases, and so because they reference both cases.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When you say both cases, we split the cases between a complaint and the PCNN?
Yes, we gave the complaint a new number.
Okay.
But then the complaint really should get docketed in the PCNN, at least until we figure out what the procedure is going to be.
Okay.
You know, so that's going to happen. And I did not differentiate them on this back page. I just kind of went in order what had been filed. Now, we do have the administrative rule that governs complaints, 69020202. We have Chapter 2832, which I didn't put in there, but that's our standard administrative procedure. And then we have the administrative rule that governs withdrawals of pleadings, which is 69020207. And I just highlighted some of the key points of that in the memo.
I had a question on that, Alana.
Okay.
The last bullet that requires a commission approval if hearing has been held or convened. I mean, isn't that basically that one of the first decisions we have to do is decide, you know, because we haven't done anything on this. So do we have to make a decision for them to pull it back? Central to.
I do not think that we have to give approval
to
that withdrawal at this point in time. We have had a tradition of acknowledging those. Now, that's not necessarily required either, but back in the day, you know, like Commissioner Hagan would say, you want something in the minutes that it happened. So they kind of invented this process of acknowledging but not giving approval. And I guess I'm okay with all of that, and I don't think, I mean, I
just
really...
There's something implied when you acknowledge it?
Well, it's implied that you got it. You know, that you got it and you noticed it. I mean, the docket implies that you got it. The acknowledgement is like, well, we got it, and, you know, we understand what's happening. I mean, I think the word acknowledge is probably a good word. Now, that acknowledge motion has a little bit of a history with the PSC for other purposes, too, and we could someday address whether that's a good thing or a bad thing or a useful thing to continue. But it has been how we have prepared these motions in the past. And the rule actually says held or convened, And so if it's already held, it's already held. If it's, we have interpreted, staff has interpreted convene, meaning like the notice of hearing issued. So if you're before that point in time, I don't think approval is required under our own rule. Okay? And then combined with that, which we would get into now in the next section of the law, the territorial integrity law, just because something is withdrawn and just because something is acknowledged as withdrawn does not necessarily mean that anybody agrees or disagrees with the question of jurisdiction. But there is a specific couple of places, specific procedure in the Territorial Integrity Act for enforcing that act. So that gives a little more, you know, credence to the, it's probably okay to withdraw. Doesn't mean it's not going to be an issue that has to be somehow litigated.
Let me ask this. The presumption that we all make by the request to withdraw is that they want to avoid an issue as opposed to they have no interest in building it any longer, right?
Well, I think...
Is that a fair...
I think that's what the conclusion we come to, but I don't know that we, staff, has any actual facts that would support such a thing, which would sort of lead to whether staff was ready to file a complaint. Does staff only knows what we hear around in the halls, which is all hearsay, basically.
Right.
Now, you have a complaint filed by another party that perhaps has more of a factual basis for those allegations. Yeah. And that's why back in just discussing the notice of withdrawal, you know, Pat had mentioned, you know, it would be premature for staff to file a complaint. Like, if staff either, if they actually were turning dirt or if staff had some other factual basis to prove that they were about to turn dirt, then staff might have to stop and say, okay, do we think it's jurisdictional or not so we can go file a complaint. But that is premature, I think, from a staff point of view because we don't have firsthand knowledge of any of the facts. I don't think. Do we, Pat? Do you? Okay.
No, I don't.
So at least at this point in time this morning. So you have this withdrawal, then you get into the territorial integrity law, and I was in kind of a hurry and I didn't feel well, so I didn't go into great detail, but I was trying to pick out the operative words. It's best to read that statute 50 times yourself because it's a little convoluted, but it does talk about filing a complaint if there's a violation of the statute and filing a complaint if an extension is unreasonably interferes or is about to interfere with the service or system. We've had complaints in this. The commission has had complaints filed on both of those issues in the past. And, of course, the entity filing the complaint has the burden of proof to prove that. The commission does have fairly broad authority to restrain or make other kinds of decisions under that act. And I did want you to note there are special definitions for the sections from 01 to 01.5, I believe it is. And then the rest of the statute is back to your general definitions. But later in the rest of the statute, toward the end there in 03-05, it does talk about municipalities, public authorities, anybody else filing complaints with a similar basis, which is going to get to the question of whether this whole thing of sovereignty needs to be asserted by somebody else.
Sure.
Or not. I don't know the answer to that today. But it's certainly, the statute was certainly written with all of those possibilities, I think. And then the final point that, you know, the commission on its own motion, with or without complaint, could restrain construction or operation. But again, the commission needs some factual basis, somebody, staff or somebody saying, oh my gosh, this is happening, we need to do something. I don't think we have that at this point in time. Then the other statute that has been mentioned substantially is 4902.02.1. Now, 4902 itself, the chapter, is the general powers of the commission. 0201.1 is the standard exception that limits your jurisdiction over cooperatives, and it's been used a lot and read a lot for that purpose. I haven't quoted the whole thing here, but and I haven't had time to read all the cases, plus all the other cases that weren't mentioned, and the legislative history, and I need to do all of those things before I would have a better legal opinion. But we have always understood the beginning of this exception to mean that if you are a municipal utility or a state utility or a cooperative utility, then the commission cannot interfere, make any order that affects or interferes with your rates, contracts, services, adequacy, sufficiency. I have never interpreted that like interfering with a contract, say, would be a state. The state setting rates for streetlights is somehow interfering with the contract between Bismarck and MDU. But, you know, I'm open to learning. And there's a little bit of allegation in these documents about that.
Yes, there sure is.
Now, the most enlightening thing that I had forgotten was in this section is the last sentence, which was written not all that long ago, I believe, during telephone deregulation, if I'm not mistaken. However, it's pretty darn clear. Nothing limits the authority of the commission under 4903 and 03.1. And it's pretty simple and pretty clear and may be the controlling answer. I don't know. And then I had these other questions, and I think there's two that rise to the top. Of the group there, they're in two groups. One is, and I think this is probably the most important question of as far as the policy implications from this debate over jurisdiction, and that is, if there is no state judgment about economic waste and wasteful duplication and public convenience and necessity, if you think back to all of the discussions in, like, Capital and MDU Boulder Ridge debate, if there is no state determination of those issues, then is it appropriate for regulated ratepayers or ratepayers from the regulated business paying for the investment and or benefiting from the investment or covering the losses or whatever? I think that's a central issue that nobody's addressed and that I would want some information and some answers on. And related to that is, if the companies have never separated out those investments and revenues, are they precluded from making the argument now? That gets a little bit more to whether jurisdiction can ever be waived. But it should be addressed.
But at least a practical outcome.
It certainly is. And my question is, you don't know that we've ever – well, let me back up. Have we ever – can you, Pat, for example, with your experience in years and same Jerry, recall ever a situation where we just sort of presumed it or granted it or it's ever been even been discussed? My suspicion is that we have – that has happened a lot, and we've just never thought about it. That's my suspicion, that there's certain situations that should be isolated from rate recovery but probably would have been addressed in a rate case if anywhere.
Regarding this issue, yeah. I'd say I don't recall any where we've, you know, addressed this issue and said, you know, ever made an argument that some rate base should be excluded from rate base.
I'm confident of that. My question is, are there similar, certainly not identical, because this, I have to say, seems quite unique. I mean, there's no community close to this. You know, this is the middle of the country. But, you know, cases where we just perhaps allowed things into rate base that upon a closer scrutiny maybe shouldn't have been.
See.
It's like the Bismarck street lighting thing. Have we ever?
I have no idea.
No, I don't.
But not doing, not separating something out, is an action in and of itself that I would presume sets some precedent.
Yes.
Or at least some tradition.
There's an argument there, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the problem. And then what does that mean? Mm-hmm. If you did it as sort of a default position, mm-hmm. which is why I really honestly think that that issue needs company response. And because we don't have the information, at least I don't.
Yeah. I was trying to recall if there's anything that Nodak Electric had said in any of their responses about construction, but I don't
think
there might be, but I don't know them well enough. Sorry.
The East End Outlet, there's construction going on out there right now. There's power being provided by Nodak for related activities, if you will.
I did see that. But I'm thinking more about, you know, you have a massive rate case, take the one tomorrow, and I don't want staff to be on the spot here, but you have a massive rate case and buried in all those documents someplace. There's no rate design issues, so we're not really delving into it. Is there a little bit of carved out, I don't know, you know, non-jurisdictional service to Fargo and Grand Forks? I don't know. I have no idea, and I don't know what it means if we've never noticed it before, which is why I think the company's under an obligation to answer the question and explain.
I do, too. The other, I always start from kind of a practical standpoint. I don't know what the law says. I'll have to study it more, but it would seem like an absurd outcome to allow that to happen. I mean, if there's any way to prevent that from happening, I think we need to read the law to prevent it, because you wouldn't want an investor-owned utility going out, for example, and not alleging they're doing it, but making absurd investments that would encumber ratepayers to pick up the tab for bad choices that the utility has
made.
Well,
and let's not
you'd have to have commission oversight.
Let's not forget that in this type of a process where it's not just might be an absurd investment. And again, I'm not alleging that this is either, but rate deals.
Well, what if XL, I mean, the city of Fargo says, we want you to build whatever. I mean, you know, some 20-cent a kilowatt hour biomass plant. And, you know, for service to our city, you'd have to, no, XL's a big company, but you'd want commission authority over that, because it could impact other ratepayers, the company's creditworthiness, so on and so forth.
Right. Well, the other part of that is, you know, in theory, you could solve that by totally allocating the costs and the revenues.
Right.
However, what you then have left with, I have nothing to base this on, but this is my instinct, that you would, your ratepayer base, the people that are paying the regulated rates, would not be benefiting.
Right.
You know, the economy of scale would be defeated. Right. And so then you would end up with an uneconomic, I mean, I'm just guessing, because Pat and I talked about this Friday and we didn't know the answer, but it seems like you would have more of an uneconomic rate base than for the regulated ratepayer.
I think it makes sense to go back to the company and get some questions, because this just doesn't make sense. I mean, we see MDU and Montreal Williams working together, carving out their territories. We see up in Garrison the same kind of thing. There's something that's we're missing here.
Let me ask this. Yeah, there is a pretty major difference here in that we're not near a community. I mean, to me, that's...
There's a reach. They're trying to find something here that there's for some reason.
No, I get the reason. But the my question is, there is a complaint before us now.
Yes, there is.
So does all that other PCNN stuff, I mean, should we be dealing with one or the other? Should we have the complaint? We don't need it. We don't need staff to initiate a complaint or...
No, we have a complaint. We have a complaint. We have all those...
So in terms of working all this out, I think Brian's right that, you know, the company should answer some of these questions. But do we bring them in here and have an oral argument discussion with them so that they can help us flesh this stuff out?
Well, that was my question, though, Kevin, about they have a complaint and they request to withdraw it. Do we have to do something there that lets them do that? Because it seems to me that's like a first decision. Either we just let them take it back, and then we deal with what comes next.
Well,
that's like the first decision
first
point to me would be that.
Question for the commission is, do we do the standard procedure, which we would do if we had nothing more, motion acknowledging withdrawal? And
doesn't apply anything.
To anything, right.
No bias.
Now, the complaint, well, the letter that came in from the co-op after the complaint, makes a couple suggestions. And I went through this all fast, but so if I misstate anything, I apologize. But I believe they suggest that they suggest a time frame and that it doesn't have to take too long and it could all be done in time for power. They suggest that the cases be consolidated, the PC&N case and the complaint case. And they also suggest, and I don't know exactly how I feel about this yet, but we'll figure it out, that it's not a good idea to decide just the jurisdiction question without the facts of the complaint. So they're saying, and again, read it thoroughly, which I didn't really have time to do, but I think they're saying that the jurisdiction and the actual facts of who deserves a PC&N kind of are so entwined that just decide, you know, to have the whole thing together, basically. And there may be some merit to that. I'd need to look into that a little bit.
Just from a standpoint of judicial economy, it might be nice to kind of get everything done together. But I don't know if that arises legal issues.
I don't know either. I have to go back and figure that out.
It's all going to end up.
The legal issue of jurisdiction, you know, is purely a legal issue, but there's probably, I mean, if you're going to have questions about things, those are, you know, could be factual questions and you need the fact hearing going on.
Who is it that who suggested that?
I think it was Nodak.
Was it Nodak?
Yes, she's nodding. Yes.
Well, I guess I was thinking that if we just held them all together and decided all the issues together, it would mean that we're saying that the company shouldn't be able to withdraw their application.
No.
And us just to acknowledge it.
No, because if you had the whole hearing and you decided there was no jurisdiction, then you would never get to anything else. And if you had the whole hearing and you decided there was jurisdiction, you might say they have to file. If you were going to give it to them, you might have to file for a PC&N. But if you had the whole hearing and decided there was jurisdiction, but they don't deserve a PC&N, you know.
They would have to file again.
They'd have to file again, yeah, but it might be a routine thing.
If they've withdrawn and they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we decide they can do that and we can just acknowledge it, then they'd have to file again.
Right. But it wouldn't, it might be a routine filing by that point in time.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But does, in fact, as Nodak asserts, all of this is enough for a prima facie determination that they're planning to build a power line to the, and their complaint is based on those facts. Is that enough to move forward with the complaint?
Oh, I think that there's enough to say it's a prima facie case. I don't think there's any question about that. There may not be enough facts to show that there. I mean, I don't know what the defense will be. I mean, I didn't even read the answer, so I apologize. But as far as a prima facie case, I mean, it just has to be barely related. So
did you hear it in the hallway?
So, you know, I don't know that you have to, I mean, you can think about all this. You don't have to decide today whether you're acknowledging the withdrawal or consolidating or anything else if you don't want to. I mean, I have there's a lot of legal research to be done yet. There's a lot of legislative history and cases to read.
Walk me through again the differences when the Territorial Integrity Act, the dates on those to some of the later decision dates.
Well, the Territorial Integrity Act was 1965.
So there's a question that needs to be answered.
Huge questions about the cases before 65. Yes. And I did have John pull some of the legislative history from 4903, which is like 100 years old, but between then and 65, you know, what kind of language were we dealing with? And I haven't read it yet. It's in a file. And there may be some other things, you know, some further background that needs to be researched.
But then tie that into the comments about nothing in this section limits the authority of the commission granted under Chapters 4903. I mean, what's the tie into those?
Okay, well, that wasn't written, I don't believe, in 65. I'm going by memory here, not by real facts. I'm going by the fact that I think that was written during telephone controversies, telephone deregulation.
It wasn't related to anything telecom, was it?
It was like the buy sells, and I'd have to go back to the exact date, and then I could pinpoint controversy.
I understand the reason for it, because any decision in 4903, in a sense, has an effect on rates, contract services, rent. I mean, I can see why you'd want a clear line there. But
well, and then don't forget, you have that other little telephone thing where the of the small but, you know, small but not co-op, and you and they're in a sort of middle gray area. I have to get the actual date on that. However, if the legislature had intended to say, you know, that something in 4902.01.1 did affect the authority under 4903 for state entities or something, that they would have said so. And you have that same thing in the Territorial Integrity Act. You have that set of
have their facts, which they fill back them up because
yes, and their legal research and all of that, and they are entitled to provide. This is just preliminary thoughts, but there is that list of exceptions.
You need to jump in the middle of it, just figure out how. I think, but I think the but withdraw and acknowledge that that's an easy first step to me.
Well, I definitely think your complaint is the place to litigate this issue. That is what it says in the chapter.
Here's where I'm sort of leaning with this, which is
now that you're older and wiser.
Yes, now that I'm no longer a young man, I've decided that we hire attorneys who are really smart about process type issues. And I mean, the commission needs to be focused on the sort of the facts of the case and deciding the case itself. Right. To me, this is all, I mean, at least these preliminary issues are procedural type issues. And however, my guess is whatever guidance, Alana, that you give us and say this is the way it makes most sense, I would be inclined to accept.
Yeah, I would agree. Diving in the middle, to use your language, is not where I'm.
I don't mean us. I guess when I say the commission, we can make the organization, the three of us.
If there's some intractable, you know, judgment call that just has to be made by the commission and only the commission can make it, that's fine. But otherwise, I'm comfortable having Alana, you, and Mark just kind of dig into this thing and come up with a procedural way to to at least get these preliminary issues out of the way, and then we can deal with the facts.
But the big grill in the room is the differences in statute over time.
Okay, well, we will do that. We will talk with Public Utilities, and, you know, the only reason I want to say something right now is because I invariably will change my mind by tomorrow, and then I have to say I'm changing my mind. If you give us another day to think about it, we'll give you a suggested procedure.
Yeah, we don't need it now.
No.
Now, had we thought back during the session to have a filing fee for complaints in addition to PCNNs, that would have been a really wise move. Too late now.
Boy, it sure would have.
So
you might have gotten some opposition to that, though.
Yeah, I know.
It wouldn't have been as easy as the other one.
Okay.
The whole bill.
Any other questions from you guys?
The practical aspect, though, of this, the April construction time frame, if this thing is still churning on, all of a sudden they need to flip the switch on, how would that lay out if this is yet to be decided? Because I've read different sides. I want to know your opinion on that.
I think that either side can, within their own current authority, that can flip the switch. And if Otter Tail were to do that and needs a temporary authority, they could ask for that subject to all their claims that they don't really need to ask, and that the two entities should just make sure there's power and, you know, tie up whatever loose ends.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And also, it's just like every other
one. I mean, I think they can do it, and I think it's a routine thing here, and that everybody can protect their arguments and interests for the rest of the hearing process if they need.
Is there any merit to talk to the Water Commission about any of this or tie them in? Or is there's no sense in that?
Not for us. No value for us to do that.
Well, I mean, unless you get, the only place it would come in is if you do end up with a full-blown TIA case, then customer preference is one of the criteria.
In the co-op suggested procedure, they mention sending notice to the Water Commission, which is probably, I mean, there's always general notice, but it's probably not a bad idea to give them specific notice.
They're certainly party to the case.
Yeah.
Participants at the very minimal.
Okay, so we'll, in a day or two, give you a suggested procedure, if that's okay.
I think that's great.
Works for me. Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? Seeing none, thanks, everybody.